This is Gil Manser welcoming you to Word by Word Conversations with Writers on KRCB 91.1 FM in Santa Rosa, where tonight's guest is the prolific film critic, author, journalist, and documentary filmmaker, Richard Schickel, whose latest book, Conversations with Scorsese, is exactly what it says, a carefully edited selection of numerous conversations Richard had with Martin Scorsese, the writer-director of films like Mean Streets, Raging Bull, Goodfellas, The Aviator, Gangs of New York, Shutter Island, and his Oscar-winning The Departed. Born on February 10, 1933, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Richard Warren Schickel is the film critic for Time magazine, and he also writes for Life magazine and the Los Angeles Times Book Review. A recipient of the Guggenheim Fellowship in 1964, Richard has also lectured at Yale University and the University of Southern California School of Film and Television. He followed his love of movies to write over 30 books and make dozens of documentaries about Hollywood, superstars, and filmmakers. Richard, I want to welcome you to Word by Word. Now, tell us a little bit, or our listeners a little bit, sure, about how this book came about, because it sounds like the editing process alone would have taken years and years.
No, it didn't take years and years. It took months and months. It was pretty simple. I mean, Marty and I have known each other for a very long time, dating back to the time I was doing The Men Who Made the Movies, my first television series. And, you know, we knew each other the way people know each other around New York. when I moved to Los Angeles and really threw my television production career into higher gear, he was just such a wonderful, natural figure to go interview on all kinds of movie subjects. I mean, there was no movie subject Marty couldn't talk about and talk about very intelligently. So more and more, I would use him as a, you know, kind of a witness on these television shows. And we became friendlier and friendlier. And then I made a 90-minute film about Marty and his career. And, you know, not too long after that, I was in New York and I was over at Marty's doing on some errand or other. And it was late to lunch with my editor at Knopf. And, you know, I apologized that I'd been over with Marty. And he said, you know, we've always wanted to do one of our conversations books with him. I mean, that's a little series of books they have of Q&As with prominent artistic figures, basically. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, you know, I think he might enjoy to do that. And, you know, so it evolved really as simply as that. It was a logical moment, and I was a logical person to interview him. So that's what happened. I can't remember how many times we met, but they were lengthy sessions, and they were often at night. We might start at, say, 8 or 8:30 and still be rolling along at 12:30 or 1 in the morning.
Right.
Night's a very good time to do this kind of interviewing, you know.
And it seems obvious.
The phones are shut off, yeah, and people aren't interrupting you. And, you know, it's nighttime. You get a little looser and easier conversationally, I think, at 8, 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night. So, yeah, you're right. You know, these weren't all consecutive. We didn't, you know, like devote 12 consecutive nights to conversations. They took place over 2 to 3 years. And, you know, there's obviously a lot of repetition in that sort of thing. There's a lot of organizing, you know, that, you know, he's talking about a movie, at, you know, on Reel 2, and then he doesn't come back to it till Reel 8. Well, then you've got to combine Reel 2 and Reel 8
right,
in order to make it coherent. But I did try to keep it chronologically more or less in order, you know. Childhood, boyhood, high school, college, first films, later films, mature films, etc. So that it wasn't so much editing as moving material around so that it was in a logical position in the book.
You should know that my degrees are in educational psychology, so that I found the part about his childhood fascinating.
Oh, yeah, I do too.
The discussions that go on about his father and mother, about the uncle who is in the gangster world.
Well, a crazy uncle.
Yeah, yeah.
He was kind of a beloved figure, but he was a flake. He's the basis.
And a dangerous figure.
Well, yeah, but he's the basis of Bob De Niro's character in Mean Streets.
Right.
That character is pretty much the uncle, you know, Marty's father's brother. And, you know, you're just a wild guy. There are people like that in this world, and they cause, they're sort of lovable, but they cause the people around them a lot of trouble. I mean, Marty talks about his father having to have what they call sit-downs with the mob guys in the neighborhood. You know, Marty's father was a respected figure in the neighborhood. He was no mobster, but he could at least talk to those guys and talk them out of, you know, kneecapping the uncle for whatever the uncle had done.
Right. Well, and then his father, Marty's father would go in and pay off part of the debt or make some kind of deal to do something to help mitigate the circumstances.
I don't think he had to do a lot of that, but he had to do... I think Marty's father... I obviously didn't know, but he was a man of respect. People trusted him, mm-hmm. So he could be a mediator on behalf of the uncle, on behalf of other people he knew. You know, he was, as I say, in that neighborhood, a man on all sides who was respected.
Right. He's a man that Marty loved unconditionally, as you say in the book, the father.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, Marty's relationship with his parents, I think, was, you know, kind of remarkably free of adolescent rebellion and that sort of thing. I mean, I think he liked his parents, who were very contrasting personalities. His mm-hmm. father was kind of, oh, I wouldn't say doer, but, you know, not a... not a good fella, let's put it that way. And there's where his mother, on the other hand, was very voluble and funny and a warm spirit. And they were not really – they both worked in the garment district. Marty's dad, of course, as almost everybody knows, was didn't know quite what to do with this sickly, at the time, asthmatic young man.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, because he couldn't do sports and he couldn't do all kind of roughhouse that the other neighborhood kids did. So, you know, the father kind of just started taking him to the movies on the weekend because it was something that little Marty enjoyed. And, you know, and from that little acorn, the mighty oak has grown, because there's something in the ritual viewing of movies, you know, the big screen, the spectacle that's on it, the issues it raises. It's sort of church-like, you know, at least it's, so it seems certainly to Marty. And
well, I think any of us who went to those big movie palaces remember things that way, too.
Oh, sure, yeah. Anyway, it worked out. It worked out really quite well for Marty, obviously. I get, you know... For example, the parents were not themselves very religious. Thus, Marty's religious phase, where, you know, he looked for a fairly brief time that he might embrace the priesthood, do something like that. That was his form of rebellion. His parents were very secular Catholics. They weren't much interested in the church and its workings. So
he actually says his mother went to church, got upset with what the priest asked too many personal questions, and so she never went back.
That's right. Yes, that's true. None of his business.
Right, right. Well, of course, the thing that I found was remarkable was this kind of bonding he was having with his dad by going to the movies, and how he peppers, mm-hmm. you know, the conversation that he's having with you with all the films that he still remembers seeing as a youngster. And you comment later about how, you know, when we're 12 or 13, those films shape our image of what we think things are real at the time.
Oh, I think that's definitely true. I mean, there is a kind of age of consent, if you will, between a young person and movies, if he's interested, mm-hmm. he or she is mm-hmm. interested in movies. And, I mean, that does shape our sensibilities. And Marty is, of course, a lot of people never quite get past that. I mean, in other words, they don't stay intellectually engaged in movies after, let's say, they've gotten out of college and, you know— started to have families and don't really have the time or the energy to keep up with the movies. But so they sort of get – they're kind of in a state of arrested development in terms of their relationship to movies. That obviously is not true of Marty, because you know, it persisted. I mean, he outgrew going to the movies with his father, who was going on his own recognizance. And then whole lots of things were opening up. You know, at that particular time in New York, there was an institution there on WOR-TV called Million Dollar Movie,
right,
which played the same movie every night, I think at 8 o'clock at night. So if you were really interested, and that might include Citizen Kane, so if you were really interested in a particular movie, you had a chance to study it. You know, you watch it Monday night, you watch it Tuesday, you go right on to Friday. That was influential on Marty. There were a series of Italian films. I mean, you know, that's, you know, New York is a bunch of niche markets, and one niche is certainly Italian Americans. So one of the channels had, you know, all that great Italian neorealism,
Bicycle Thief,
movie
and things
making,
like that. Right?
Yeah, that kind of thing that came along in the immediate post-war years, and that was influential on Marty. And you know, then just, you know, his own sort of groping his way through movie history, you know, picking up on, you know, directors as disparate as, let's say, John Ford on the one hand, and maybe
Sajid Ray, for example, on the other.
I don't know about Sajid Ray.
Well, he's mentioned in here because I got to know.
Well, that's because I was a nut for Sajid Ray.
Okay.
I'm not sure, Marty. That might be one of the lacunae in Marty's movie-going history. But I'm sure he's seen all of Rye's films and enjoyed them and could comment on them. I mean, that's the deal with and one obvious motive in my doing this book. I mean, he's just so world historically aware of movies. So it's wonderful to do it with him. I mean, I'm pretty good at that myself. I mean, I have a good historical understanding of motion pictures, of movies.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we can treat each other more or less as equals, which makes this book different from the usual Q&A book with a director in that, you know, it is two equals, two people who really know movies, having a conversation about
and an opinion about
they
a film.
Love.
That's
and
right.
Have a, well, Marty's opinion is always the same. He loves it. I mean, it's very hard to find. You know, to find
well,
Marty
he's very
saying,
specific.
Well, I don't care for that much.
I don't know. He took Shane apart, for instance, on several other films.
Oh, but he loves Shane.
He loves it, but he always, you know, he says, but they could have done that part better, and they could have done this part better.
Well, yeah, but in the context of Marty's sort of all-encompassing movie love, I don't think he would be – I would be much more prepared to criticize a movie because that's my approach to movies. I approach them as a film critic and a film historian. So they're beloved movies that I can point out, you know, huge flaws in if I feel like it. You know, for example, we got to talking about John Ford and his Westerns in particular. And of Ford's rather mixed body of work.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a gigantic Fordian. I kind of like those best, but I had to point out to him that, you know, his endemic failing as a filmmaker, you know, the sloppy Irish sentimentality of his films. He said, well, it's not in the cavalry Westerns. And I said, well, you're wrong. I mean, there are sequences.
Oh, yes, there are.
Ford Apache and so forth.
Yeah.
They go down to the you know, the non-commissioned officers barracks, and they're bawling these ballads. And, you know, I can't stand that stuff. I mean, if I mean, I'd cut them out of those movies. But that's part of Ford, so you have to accept. You do. I mean, that's true of any filmmaker or any novelist, for that matter. You have to excuse them their flaws. They almost all have obvious flaws, and you have to say, yes, but. Yes, there's that flaw. I don't care for it. But overall, I love the movie. And I think that's kind of the approach Marty would take to most films.
Well, interestingly enough, one film that does come up over and over again through the book is The Searchers.
Mm.
And how you comment about, and Marty comments back and forth several times about how it's, you know, that quest has shaped something similar in one of Martin's.
Well, that for his generation. See, that movie came out just as those kids were in their adolescence.
The right age.
And I think they hadn't actually seen a movie of that type. To me, the movie is flawed by, again, by its sentimental implications, by, you know, the sort of improbable – reformation of John Wayne from a man who's determined to kill his niece because she has been ruined by her relationship with Scar, the Indian who abducts her as a child.
Right.
And, you know, I find that very discomforting, that film. I mean, I concede its beauty. I concede the towering quality of John Wayne's performance in it. I mean, he was never better than he was in that film. But on the other hand, you know, there's a lot of, to me, near racist jokes about, the Indian woman who keeps following them around.
The sexism that comes across in The Quiet Man.
Oh, I can't stand The Quiet Man. I think it's one of the worst movies ever made. I loathe.
See, you're not shy about voicing an opinion about a film, are you?
Well, no. I mean, you know, if you're involved with film, I mean, you can't love every film. You may love filmmaking.
Or parts of a film.
May love film going, you know. But, I mean, you are watching movies that are often flawed. So, yeah, of course I'm Marty is a little more tolerant. I mean, he's a little more likely to forgive a movie its flaws because of its overall character. But I don't see any particular reason for that. I mean, I think my involvement with movies is probably more ambiguous than Marty's is. You know, I don't know why that is. Whether it's the direction I'm coming from the critical historical point of view, or whether it's just, you know, difference in our natures.
I'm a more
sardonic figure than Marty is.
Maybe, or he's remembering in a different way because he's obviously seeing it as scenes and dolly cuts and, how things were edited and how lighting was done way before, most of
us
even knew about
that. Well,
yes,
that's true. That's true. I mean, he is more likely than I am to come in a movie from a technical point of view. On the other hand, as I'm recalling this book and the interviews it contains, he doesn't always come at them from, the point of view of cuts or angles or what have you. I mean, he's looking at movies pretty much the way all of us look at movies, from a moral point of view, historical point of view. I don't think, Marty can talk cuts and angles with you till the cows come home, but I don't think that is his principal approach to movies, except in this instance. I mean, he's having a really photographic memory for old movies and how they were put together. It's perfectly clear to me that he will, from time to time, attempt to emulate some great shot or sequence of shots in some movie that he remembers, which may be entirely different in its generic character than the movie he's making, but he will attempt to emulate those things because he thinks they're fabulous. And he's generally speaking correct about that.
He also, you make reference to Alfred Hitchcock and how he basically made the same movie over and over again. And I have the feeling,
that was your point.
I have the feeling that Martin's kind of gets scenes in movies, the next movie that he couldn't get in this movie or two movies ago. Would you agree?
You mean in terms of aping something that hits?
Well, in
something
that
he
has in the back of his mind that he really wants to use, in a particular way.
I have a feeling that's a little more casual than you think it is. He may be on. As you know from the book, Marty storyboards absolutely every sequence he makes. I mean, there's nothing.
As did Hitchcock.
Yeah, Hitchcock used to say, well, once I've done that, it's almost boring to do the movie because you're just following. I mean, they better be following what his storyboards are. I think Marty may be a little looser about that, but not all that much. I mean, in its essence, the job of directing a movie is a job for a control freak. I mean, you pretty much got to have a movie very planned out before you go on the stage to shoot it. And you've got to have a pretty good reason to vary what you're shooting from your storyboard. Now, there are plenty of directors, great directors, who don't storyboard at all, mm-hmm. you know. Eastwood doesn't. Aaliyah Kazan never did. You know, they're on the set, and their involvement is with the performers and, to a degree, you know, with the cameramen and all the other technical people there. Their job, they feel, is to direct the movie in a much more intimate way than Marty does. I mean, Marty gets on a set, he gets behind his video village, which offers him, you know, a number of different images showing different alternatives to the coverage he's shooting and so forth. And he doesn't get up there next to the camera and engage with the actors. A director like Clint Eastwood is the opposite. I've never seen him behind a video village. I mean, he's always up there next to the camera, following very closely what the actors are doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he is not a man who particularly wants to change what an actor's impulses are leading him to do, but he's available to them, available to discuss that, discuss choices, and so forth. But that's a very different way of directing, and I think maybe a more traditional way of directing than the way that Marty directs when he's on the stage.
Well, he definitely has an intensity of style that everybody comments about.
Yeah. I don't think he's I don't mean to imply at all that he's a very intrusive director. You know, I mean, people, there's a lot of mythology around directing. You know, most directors will say, well, you know, if you've cast it right, you've done 80% of your job before you even walked out there. I think Marty would probably agree with that. So casting, just who's going to play the part, is a huge part of a director's decision-making process.
The interesting thing that I noticed is that consistently is you basically have broken the book up into chapters about each movie. Mm-hmm. And essentially they stay, you know, true to that film in that chapter. Although
but there are cross references,
yes,
in it,
sure. But over and over again, Scorsese seems to say, "Well, that's not the movie I really wanted to make." Would you agree? Gangs of New York, for example, The Departed, even, mm-hmm. which won him his Oscar. He felt that he was constrained by the studio system. He says,
"I don't think that's true."
I didn't know that it was true either, but that seems to be. If you read that, you know, which I did. Sit down and read this through, you get the consistent feeling, well, you know, I wanted to do that a different way from Scorsese.
That may be true. That's not my overall impression of the interview. I mean, I could be wrong. I could just be too close to the interview. But my feeling is that Marty, once he has committed to an idea of the film and mm-hmm. begun sketching it out in his number two pencils, which he hopes he has now enough left to last him his lifetime. I mean, he's funny about those pencils, you know, but that's part of his compulsive.
They have to be a certain brand
nature.
Or something?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Certain brand. And the brand, they canceled the brand he loved. And so they have a substitute with the same name, but they aren't the same to Marty. But he's got, I forget, four boxes of them. And, you know, he thinks he's got enough of them left. So he can sketch his way to the end of his career.
Lucille Ball's hair dye.
Well, whatever. Yeah.
You know story about where she was running out of henna and somebody sent it to her from some other part of the world?
No, I have never heard that.
Okay. So maybe we should put a call out for a specific kind of pencil for Marty. So there's somebody.
They don't make them anymore.
Well, there's somebody with a box in a drawer somewhere, I bet.
Well, no, he found on, I think, eBay, you know, somebody with six boxes of the pencils he needed. Probably paid an inordinate price to obtain them.
Sure.
And, you know, he has them. And I think it takes him, it doesn't take him that many pencils to sketch a movie, four or five or six, you know, and so I think he's got enough. He's 68 years old. How many movies can he make? Well, Clint's still making him at age 81.
Sure.
So, I don't know. These are the kind of vagaries that come up when you're dealing with, you know, highly talented people like Marty who are very intense about what they do. I mean, you know, if it were Clint, he'd just say, oh, well, fine, I'll use a different pencil. But Clint doesn't use a storyboard, so,
right.
You know. And he's not compulsive about stuff like that, though he may be compulsive in other ways, you know, about behavior on the set and his particular way of making a film, which is different from Marty's or Steven's or whoever. So, you know, it is a profession, directing movies, that, you know, requires people to indulge the director in habitual behaviors that have almost a talismanic quality for that director. You know, I mean, he can't really function if he doesn't do such and so. You know, it's not just, you know, luck or placating the gods of chance. I mean, these are things that they feel deeply that they need to do in order to do their job at its highest level.
Right. The other thing, of course, which I found fascinating was how long some of these projects took to actually – until they actually got, you know, filmed.
Well
– they were, you know, thought about for decades.
Yeah, so. I think that's true, though, of a lot of people. I find it's even true in my modest way. There have been in my life books I was determined to make and even some documentary films I was determined to make. And I just had to wait it out. I mean, you know, people weren't interested or, you know, we'd come close and then it wouldn't happen. And sometimes you just say, well, the gods are speaking. This isn't meant to be. But sometimes you have to say, I don't care what they say. I am going to do this at some point eventually in my life. And that's true in the case of Marty. Gangs of New York is a splendid example of a film that he and Jay Cox worked on, wrote on for, you know, probably 20 years. I mean, almost as long as I knew Marty, maybe longer. People were saying to me, you know what Marty's doing? I said, well, I think he's doing Gangs of New York. He wasn't doing it. He was hoping to do Gangs of New York.
Well, he's constantly busy on documentaries and other projects as well, which, you know, you refer to in the chapter at the end of the book. But we don't, you know, well, unless you look at a filmography by date, you don't realize how busy the man is all the time.
Well,
and you too, I should say.
Well, I think the wise director does keep busy. I mean, in other words, look, life doesn't just happen. You say, I want to do such and such. You say, right, go ahead, Marty. Here's a few million bucks. Go do it. You sometimes just have to keep pushing that peanut with your nose down the road. And, you know, Last Temptation of Christ is probably an even better example of a film. He was determined. I mean, Barbara Hershey gave him that book on the set of Boxcar Bertha.
Bertha
said,
right.
You're going to like this movie. You're going to like this book. And he did. And from that moment on, he was determined to make that film. But I forget, it was probably 20 years before that determination
at least
was
15.
Fulfilled.
That's true.
Yeah. And, you know, it went through all kinds of changes. People came very close to backing it. And then they didn't at the last minute. And, you know, he finally went out basically with a minimal crew to Morocco and shot it under very, very difficult conditions.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, what he said to me, I think he said it right in the book, but he certainly said it to me in other contexts, that was just a movie he was going to make.
Right.
Come hell or high water, that was
despite all the religious, you know, criticism from a lot of different places.
Well,
or maybe in spite of that, yeah.
No, the criticism came from a very specific corner of Catholicism, I think. See, I think Marty with that film, he understood it to be controversial, of course, because the Kazantzakis novel on which it's based is controversial. But I think he expected a kind of high-level controversy on that. I mean, you know, where he might debate
where the Catholic Legion of Decency would come out and say something and he'd say something back. Or
well,
what?
Not even though Catholic Legion of Decency is pretty low-level. I mean, he was talking, I think, about
something from,
you know,
the
discussing
Pope.
This movie with, you know, leading Catholic theologians. You know, and what he got was, you know, the lowest caste kind of booga booga kind of Catholics, you know, are out picketing, wearing funny hats and carrying stupid signs and, you know, making public displays of displeasure. This was not a high-level debate that developed out of a certain aspect of the Catholic response to The Last Temptation. And that's what disappointed him. I mean, he did not stir up the kind of high-level discussion that might have, led people to a much more thoughtful consideration of this movie and the ideas that the movie presents. So I think he came away very disappointed by that.
Well, that was his training, I guess, or early interest in the church and feeling that he could bring some kind of discussion up to date.
Well, look, Marty's relation to the church, like everything about Marty, is much more complicated than we all think it is.
A Conversation About Some Conversations could be the title of tonight's Word by Word Conversations with Writers show on KRCB 91.1 FM in Santa Rosa. In the next half hour, Richard delves into specific Martin Scorsese films like Raging Bull, The Aviator, Gangs of New York, and his Oscar-winning The Departed. Richard, you write how Scorsese told you he didn't have the quality to be a priest.
He wasn't even a very good altar boy. He says, I'm not very good in the morning. Kept for 6 a.m. Mass. Right. He isn't very good in the morning, by the way.
You were up late at night talking.
Absolutely. Right. Sure. And, he and Thelma Schoonmaker, who's his editor,
right,
they like to work at night. I mean, they very often, sit down in the cutting room at 8 o'clock at night and work through till the early hours of the morning. For the same reason that I enjoyed interviewing at odd hours, because in some ways your guard is down, or at least you're more open to different suggestions of topics or different questions you might ask that you might not think to ask in the daylight hours. So to me, it's ideal. I mean, I'm kind of a night person myself, so... and obviously Thelma is, and obviously Marty is. So it's a good time to work if you have the, body clock that responds to it.
Yep. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you, which film do you think, and this is a hard one, which film do you think Marty feels most proud of? It's sort of like asking about, which child do you like the most?
Yeah, it's funny because... I think I rather casually, almost heedlessly said, Raging Bull. I said, it's obviously your first really true masterpiece.
Right.
And he looked at me weirdly, like he hadn't paid any attention to all the stuff that's been written about it, all the stuff that's been said about it, as if to say, I don't know, I don't think that's my masterpiece or my first or last masterpiece. And... I think that's, generally speaking, true of people who are fairly prolific in their art. It's very hard to choose your favorite, I have books of mine that I like a lot for whatever reasons, but they may not be my best book. They're, to me, a happy memory, the creation of them or the response to them or what have you. So I understand his problem with that. Obviously, he certainly doesn't think ill of Taxi Driver or Raging Bull or those movies. But, he may have some secret glimmering thought about some movie that we wouldn't even think he would be that interested in.
Well, it's interesting. I think part of what makes him remember fondly some films over others is the people he's working with on the film. He chooses to work some of the same actors over and over again, and other
some of the same cinematographers.
Yeah. Exactly, and that makes
always in the last 25-30 years always Thelma editing.
Exactly,
I mean she's interesting because her temperament is the opposite of Marty's. I mean she is.
Well, you thank her for being part of this.
She's
book.
A brilliant editor, yeah. But she's a sort of large, motherly, calm woman. And, Marty's always chirping around and he's full of kind of a kinetic energy. And I think they work very well together because I think they've learned how to sort of balance their two essential moods. And that works out well for both of them. It's admirable. That's a collaboration I have witnessed because, I've been around Marty's office enough to see him with Thelma, who's, you know, really one of my favorite people. She's, you know, calm, amusing, delightful woman. And I can see how those that balance works between the two of them to the advantage of the film.
You mentioned, for instance, we keep coming back to Gangs of New York, mm-hmm. but you mentioned to Marty that one of the problems with the film is how great it starts off.
That's often true of movies, isn't it?
You know,
I mean, you get off.
It's hard.
On a
you
big
get
high.
To the third act, and it just doesn't measure up.
Well, but that was, I don't think that was Marty's fault directorially. I mean, what happened was they just ran out of money over there in Rome. You know, Marty threw his own money in, which is very rare. Most directors will not do that. Mm. Marty's done that on at least two occasions. And he said it was, feckless to do it because, let's say he put $2 or $3 million in. He said, you know, I put it in on a Monday, and by Friday we'd run through it. Now, if they had had the money, it's possible that the draft riot sequence, which ends the picture, would have topped that. But it couldn't. They just didn't have the what with to finish the picture the way they intended to.
Yeah, he talks about Harvey Weinstein coming to him and saying, well, you got 10 scenes. You got to cut it down to 3.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's something about an elephant. They wanted this elephant to go.
Oh, for that escape from Barman.
And he said, okay, but you can't have the elephant, Marty. And Marty says, I got the elephant. You know, well, the elephant is there, you know.
That's right.
But, you know, that's sort of, in some ways, you know, that's the fun of filmmaking. To see what you can get away with. You know, okay, you've got to cut 10 scenes from your picture. Or 3 scenes from your picture. You know, and you figure out a way to sneak a couple extras in on the money guy or whoever. Mm-hmm. Harvey, let's say.
Let's pause here a moment to let the listeners hear a little from the amazing scene in Scorsese's Gangs of New York. It's 1840, when the Irish gang, led by Liam Neeson, squares off in the streets of New York's Five Points neighborhood against the native-born gangs led by Daniel Day-Lewis. Both gangs are wearing leather and metal body armor and are armed with clubs and knives and axes. So blood will be shed and men will die.
By the ancient laws of combat, we are met at this chosen ground to settle for good and all. Who holds sway over the Five Points? Us natives, born rightwise to this fine land, or the foreign hordes defiling it.
The ancient laws of combat, I accept the challenge of the so-called natives. You plague our people at every turn. But from this day out, you shall plague us no more. For let it be known that the hand that tries to strike us from this land shall be swiftly cut down.
May the Christian Lord guide my hand!
You mention in the book that despite his large body of work, Scorsese is not as wealthy as other successful filmmakers.
All I'm saying is he just didn't get super rich directing movies.
Right.
He came out comfortably, let's put it that way.
Well, a lot of his
movies he deserves, for Pete's sake, you know.
But a lot of his movies are what you would call art house films still in many people's minds.
I think that's true. I see that in the performance of this book. I think thinking it over, I might have preferred to have this come out as a paperback so that it was affordable for its prime audience, which are, you know, film students and academics and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I think in some sense Marty is a cult figure. He's had very few resounding popular successes with his films.
Even his Oscar winners. Done
all right.
Not really that big box office.
Well, that's true. And, you know, what happens with those films is take Raging Bull, for example. You know, it was just, you know, people would just knock their socks off when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
Very good reviews, very good buzz amongst the more intellectual audience for movies. But it didn't do a huge amount of business. Now, over the years, it's never disappeared. You know, it's revived constantly. All that good stuff happens with this movie. But no, it was not, at the time, a huge hit. And I think that's true of almost all of Marty's movies. I mean, I don't think The Aviator, which is a late movie of his I quite like, I don't think that did huge business.
No, and I don't know why, because I think it was really, I mean, unless it's because the ends became Howard, everybody expected Howard Hughes to be, you know, kind of this wiggy guy with feet in Kleenex boxes or something.
He was wiggy. I mean, what that movie's about is pre-wiggy.
Right.
You know, it shows this man starting to crumble at a relatively early age. It elicits from Marty a lot of compassion. The movie is really quite compassionate about Howard Hughes, and the better for it. You know, it's not like just crazy old coot, you know, that we see kind of lurking around the edges of the film. I mean, he's very human in this movie. I mean, you understand that, you know, there are things in his background and so forth that prevented him from having, how to put this, a realistic view of the world and
right,
human nature.
Right.
So, but I like that movie. I think it has a lot of tragic undertow to it. And Marty likes it and understands it, I think, in the same way that I do. So there is something comical in that movie.
And there's
darkly
some
comic.
Wonderfully inventive scenes in that film. You know, the one where you know, they're on the beach, or the one where the plane is crashing through the rooftops. It's just a...
Those are fabulous scenes. I think just the scene where he's up in the air in his plane directing the aerial combat
at the beginning,
Hell's
yes.
Angel.
Yes,
that's a beautiful sequence. It's beautiful filmmaking.
Yeah.
I like Marty at his most ambitious. I mean, there's no point in being Marty Scorsese and then playing it safe, is there? I mean, that's stupid. It's a waste of his essential spirit, you know. I mean,
that's true.
So I like movies of his that take risks and take chances and all that. That doesn't mean he has to do it every time he makes a movie. But I like that the quality. Now, you know, the Shutter Island movie, which I don't much care for, that's a movie that...
Is it because you saw what was going to happen?
No, I didn't.
That's what
entirely.
Ruined it for me. I predicted the end halfway through, yeah.
Yeah, but I was a little bit surprised to understand it as entirely a kind of madman's dream.
Yeah.
I didn't quite see it that way until it became kind of obvious. But that movie is his most successful movie. You know?
Is really? I mean, you mean
for
box office numbers?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't all that expensive to shoot, and it was it's a movie that had a lot of ugga-bugga to it. So the kids went to it. I mean, you know, it was a movie that, you know, satisfied that horror film impulse that the, you know, adolescent audience likes to exercise. So it did very well. And Marty took it entirely seriously. I mean, he knew what he was doing, and, you know, good for him. I mean, I think it's good if a filmmaker does something like this that, you know, obviously has less than pure motives about it, but which also, to some degree, exercises his talents as a filmmaker, and to some degree this movie does. You know, Marty is an excellent, suspenseful filmmaker. You know, he doesn't have a problem making those kinds of movies. So it's just I don't care for the movie very much, and I don't think most people did care for the movie. Marty cared for it. He sort of fenced around with me on that. He said, you know, in effect saying, I think it has more virtues than appears to your eye at this moment. I would concede that point, sure.
You watch it in 10 years and maybe your mind will shift a little bit.
Oh, 10 years from now, my mind is going to be Shutter Island.
I see.
I mean,
okay, so for our listeners, you've mentioned, Raging Bull. What other, you know, two or three films should they absolutely must see of Martin Scorsese's?
Well, I think definitely Taxi Driver.
Okay.
I mean, it's a very difficult movie. But it has, you know, it has real authentic scariness to it, you know, in the nature of the taxi driver.
And just an ordinary sort of guy who goes off the deep
end. Well, he's an ordinary psychopath.
Well, right.
What you're talking about. I am personally, I'm very fond of King of Comedy. I think that gets at
I think Marty likes that one, too, a lot.
I think he does, too. It was difficult for him, you know. I mean, we talked about that because it's difficult for me to watch. It's a movie if I'm watching it at home on my DVD. I tend to be able to not sit through without getting up, you know, going to have a cup of coffee, reading a magazine, doing something, because I find, you know, the need of Rupert Pupkin for celebrity and, the maniacal pursuit of it by him. I just find that scary because it's so much a part of modern American
celebrity
life.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, there are scenes in that movie, you know, like when he's trying to get in to see Jerry, you know, past the receptionist and past
this
Jerry's
is Jerry
personal
Lewis,
assistant.
Right.
Yeah, Jerry Lewis playing a character named Jerry. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just scary. And this Margot Winkler, Irwin Winkler's wife, playing the first person he has to get past, the woman at the outside portal of Jerry's office. I mean, to me, that stuff is just so scary because, you know, if we aren't careful, we could all be in Rupert's position. You know, there are people we just adore and we would love to meet and we would do anything to meet them and blah, 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 blah. So I think that's a really good movie, a very intense movie, very powerful to me. And the way it works out is just, you know, yeah, guess what? Rupert's a celebrity. by hook and by crook. I think it's a very, very potent, very powerful, and very sort of darkly funny movie. So I would put that, you know, right up there, you know, in my top three or four Marty movies. Look, I mean, there are movies of his I don't greatly care for. It's a very long career. But, you know, I'm not big on Mean Streets. I think it's great because for Bobby De Niro's performance in it, for what it announced was going
to
come.
It's a good starter. From the source. Yeah. Discovery.
But it's not a movie that has ever, you know, resonated with me the way, say, Raging Bull has or Taxi Driver. So
it's interesting because each of those is such more of a really intensely personal film.
Yeah. But, you know, it's funny about Marty. If you talk, let's say, about Kundun. And, you know, what you would say is autobiographical about that? Well, first of all, the obvious, the thought that, you know, this the spiritual longings of, you know, Marty as compared to that of the young people playing the Dalai Lama.
Right.
But also, you know, it's sort of Marty because of, you know, the way he was, you know, hobbled as a child by his asthma and so forth. Always being in the outsider looking in. And, you know, there are pictures that Marty took from his tenement rooftop that are the same angle as the young Dalai Lama looking down on his community from a height through his telescope and trying to perceive the reality that's going on down there and get a handle on life. Which I think is very autobiographical to Marty. I raised that with him. He sort of said, "Well, I don't know about that, but I do know about that. That's part of Marty's how to put it spiritual quest."
As was going to church and going to the movies.
Well, the little Dalai Lama was also cranking through on his 16mm projector newsreels of. World far outside of his little world, trying to get a handle on that. I think that's probably the center of Marty's efforts as a filmmaker, to be the observer, to look on the world from some distance and try to make some sense out of it, whether it's a matter of spiritual longing or just informational longing. I mean, you know, for Marty almost like he walks down the street to NYU, which is four or five blocks from where he was growing up. And that's almost as if, you know, the people reaching out to find the new Dalai Lama, you know, reach out and find him. I mean, he goes to NYU and Haig Manoogian, his teacher and mentor, you know, reaches out for Marty. And mm-hmm. Marty's life is transformed. He's no longer, you know, some, you know, dopey kid on the streets of Little Italy. He's a person about to exercise his power over this medium that he's always loved and never imagined he would be allowed to be anywhere near. I mean, it is like an annunciation, if you will, of reaching out to young Marty by this institution. So I think a movie like Kundun may be more autobiographical than, say, Goodfellas. Goodfellas is just an observation of people kind of around the neighborhood that he sort of knew at one time in his life. But
it doesn't have a Marty character in it.
But no, it doesn't. Well, it's a little bit in Ray Liotta's. It's a little bit Marty-ish. You know, the guy kind of hanging around. And, hey, guys, choose me. Hey, I'm here. Let me work with you. Let me be with you. So that aspect of it is a little bit Marty-ish, sure. Look, any serious film artist is going to be autobiographical in ways that maybe may not even be known to him when he's making the gesture, but becomes clear to us as we look at the films later on.
Richard Schickel, we've got a couple of minutes before we close the show about your new book, Conversations with Scorsese, and I want to play a clip from Martin's Oscar-winning movie, The Departed, for our listeners. In your book, Scorsese says this about the artistry of Jack Nicholson in the role of the gang boss, Frank Costello. It was extremely collaborative. For instance, he had a little beard and he said, "Should I shave this? Do you mind? Or should I keep it?" And I said, "Keep it on." I came to realize that there was something about this character, this idea of a man slightly coming apart, that was different from my other films. Once I made the comment about the beard, it sort of set Jack free. So let's listen now to the Jack Nicholson voiceover at the opening of Martin Scorsese's The Departed.
When I was your age, they would say we could become cops or criminals. What I'm saying is this. When you're facing a loaded gun, what's the difference?
This is not the regular police! This is the state police!
We are an elite unit.
This is who we're after.
Frank Costello.
Well, yeah. I do want to thank you so much, Richard Schickel, for Conversations with Me on Word by Word Conversations with Writers and Conversations with Scorsese. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Word by Word Conversations with the Writers show on KRCB 91.1 FM in Santa Rosa or streaming online at krcb.org, where the award-winning film critic, documentarian, movie historian, and biographer Richard Schickel discusses his newly released Conversations with Scorsese. The topics range from Martin Scorsese's hardscrabble upbringing on the streets and in the movie houses of New York's Lower East Side to the making of Scorsese's own films like Raging Bull, The Aviator, Gangs of New York, and his Oscar-winning The Departed. Our studio engineer for tonight's show has been Mark Fuller, and I am your host, Gil Manser. We invite you to tune in for a special Word by Word program right here on KRCB 91.1 FM at 7 p.m. Wednesday, June 22nd, when we will present the 8 winners from the Sebastopol Center for the Arts Bibliophoria Teen Writing Contest. Prompted by the words, "Books are," talented writers from West County junior highs and high schools submitted their short stories or essays for consideration. Part of their winning prize is to have these read on KRCB by professional actors, and the chance to talk about their writing on the air. In case you haven't heard, Bibliophoria is a multifaceted celebration of the art of the book. Running through the months of June and July, in addition to the Books Are Teen Writing Contest, which is sponsored by KRCB, the Sebastopol Center for the Arts, and Copperfield Books, there are art shows, a sculpture jam, a poetry chapbook contest and readings, visits to artists and writers' studios, minstrels telling stories, concerts for children, parents, and grandparents, workshops on writing, illustrating, and making books, a conference for writers of children's books, and a day-long book writing workshop for young people. There are so many things to do, you will need to consult the events calendar at biblioforia.com. That's BIBLIOPHORIA.com. Our next word-by-word conversations with writers will be at 7 p.m. Wednesday, July 6th. Until then, we hope you have a delightful June filled with graduations, weddings, reunions, and summer vacations.